and around Shoreditch. Every now and then, she scrolled down a page to look through the client reviews on the remote chance that somebody might have mentioned a bouncer called Noel. But no individual was named, except the women who worked there. Punters often recommended them on the basis of their reported enthusiasm for their jobs. Mandy from one massage parlour gives full 30 minutes with never any sense of being rushed. The gorgeous Sherry of Beltway Strippers was always willing, accommodating, and up for a laugh. "I can thoroughly recommend Zoe," said one punter. "Gorgeous figure and a very happy ending." In a different mood, or perhaps in a different life, Robin might have found the way they talked about the women funny. So many of the men handing over cash for sex needed to believe that the women's enthusiasm was real, that they took their time for pleasure, that they were really laughing at punters' jokes, genuinely enjoying the body-to-body massages and handjobs. One reviewer had posted a poem about his favourite girl. Even as she diligently compiled her list of numbers, Robin thought it unlikely that Brockbank, with his insalubrious record, would have been hired by any of the more upmarket places, whose websites featured artistically lit, airbrushed naked girls and invitations for couples to attend together. Brothels, Robin knew, were illegal, but you did not have to travel too far into cyberspace to find mention of them. She had become adept at nosing information from out-of-the-way corners of the internet since going to work for Strike, and was soon painstakingly cross-referencing mentions of local establishments on ramshackle sites dedicated to the exchange of such information. Here, at the cheapest end of the market, there were no poems. £60 for anal going rate round here. All Forrigan girls, no English. Very young, probably still clean. Wouldn't put your dick in some of what you see. Often, only an approximate location was available. She knew that Strike would not let her go looking for any of these basements and tenements where mostly East European girls or all Chinese tail were working. Taking a break, and subconsciously hoping to loosen the tight knot in her chest, she looked up at the television. Princes William and Harry were walking up the aisle together. As Robin watched, the door to the sitting room opened and Matthew walked in, carrying a mug of tea. He had not offered to make her one. He sat down in the armchair, saying nothing, and stared at the television screen. Robin returned to her work, hyper-conscious of Matthew beside her. Joining her without talking was a departure. Acceptance of her separateness, not interrupting her, even with the offer of tea, was also new. So was the fact that he did not pick up the remote control and change the channel. The cameras returned to the outside of the Goring Hotel, where they were keeping vigil for the first glimpse of Kate Middleton in her wedding dress. Robin took covert glimpses over the top of her laptop while scrolling slowly down a series of barely literate comments about a brothel near Commercial Road. An outburst of excitable comment and cheering made Robin look up in time to see Kate Middleton climbing into a limousine. Long lace sleeves, just like the one she had removed from her own wedding dress. The limousine moved slowly away. Kate Middleton was just visible beside her father in the car. So she had chosen to wear her hair down. Robin had planned to keep her hair down too. Matthew liked it that way. Not that that mattered anymore. The crowds were cheering all the way down the Mall, Union Jacks as far as the eye could see. As Matthew turned towards her, Robin pretended to be immersed in her laptop again. "Do you want tea?" "No," she said. "Thanks," she added grudgingly, aware how aggressive she had sounded. Her mobile beeped beside her. Matthew often scowled or sulked when this happened on her days off. He expected it to be Strike, which it sometimes was. Today, he merely turned back to watch the television. Robin picked up her mobile and read the text that had just arrived. "How do I know you're not press?" It was the lead she was pursuing without Strike's knowledge, and she had her answer ready. While the crowds cheered the limousine's slow progress on screen, she typed in, "If the press knew about you, they'd already be outside your house. I told you to look me up online. There's a picture of me going into court to give evidence in Owen Quine's murder case. Have you found it?" She put the mobile down again, her heart beating faster. Kate Middleton was getting out of her limousine at the Abbey. Her waist looked tiny in the lace dress. She looked so happy, genuinely happy. Robin's heart hammered as she watched the beautiful woman in a tiara proceed towards the Abbey entrance. Her mobile beeped again. "Yes, I've seen the picture. So?" Matthew made a peculiar noise into his mug of tea. Robin ignored him. He probably thought that she was texting Strike, usually the cause of his little grimaces and noises of exasperation. Switching her mobile to camera mode, Robin held it up in front of her face and took a photo. The flash startled Matthew, who looked around. He was crying. Robin's fingers trembled as she sent the photograph of herself off in a text. After that, not wanting to look at Matthew, she watched the television again. Kate Middleton and her father were now walking slowly up the scarlet-carpeted aisle that divided a sea of hatted guests. The culmination of a million fairy tales and fables was being played out in front of her, the commoner walking slowly towards her prince, beauty moving inexorably towards high rank. Against her will, Robin remembered the night that Matthew had proposed under the statue of Eros at Piccadilly Circus. There had been tramps sitting on the steps, jeering as Matthew sank to his knees. She had been caught completely off guard by that unexpected scene on the grimy steps. Matthew risking his best suit on the damp, dirty stone, alcoholic fumes wafting towards them over the smell of exhaust fumes. The little blue velvet box, and then the winking sapphire, smaller and paler than Kate Middleton's. Matthew later told her he'd chosen it because it matched her eyes. One of the tramps had got to his feet and applauded drunkenly when she said yes. She remembered the flashing neon lights of Piccadilly, reflected on Matthew's beaming face. 9 years of shared life, of growing up together, of arguing and reconciling, of loving. 9 years, holding fast to each other through trauma that ought to have broken them apart. She remembered the day after the proposal, the day she had been sent by the temping agency to Strike. It seemed much, much longer ago than it was. She felt like a different person. At least, she had felt like a different person, until Strike told her to stay at home and copy down phone numbers, evading the question of when she would return to work as his partner. "They split up."
"What?"
said Robin.
"They did,"
said Matthew, and his voice broke. He nodded at the screen. Prince William had just turned to look at his bride.
"They broke up for a bit."
"I know they did," said Robin. She tried to speak coldly, but Matthew's expression was bereft. "Maybe on some level I think you deserve better than me."
"Is it? Are we really over?" he asked.
Kate Middleton had drawn level with Prince William at the altar. They looked delighted to be reunited. Staring at the screen, Robin knew that today her answer to Matthew's question would be taken as definitive. Her engagement ring was still lying where she had left it, on top of old accountancy textbooks on the bookcase. Neither of them had touched it since she had taken it off. "Dearly beloved," began the Dean of Westminster on screen. She thought of the day that Matthew had asked her out for the very first time, and remembered walking home from school, her insides on fire with excitement and pride. She remembered Sarah Shadlock giggling, leaning against him in a pub in Bath, and Matthew frowning slightly and pulling away. She thought of Strike and Ellen. What have they got to do with anything? She remembered Matthew, white-faced and shaking, in the hospital where they had kept her for 24 hours after the rape. He had missed an exam to be with her, simply taken off without leaving word. His mother had been annoyed about that. He had had to resit in the summer. I was 21 and I didn't know then what I know now, that there's nobody like you and that I could never love anyone else as much as I love you. Sarah Shadlock, arms around him when he was drunk, no doubt, while he poured out his confused feelings about Robin, agoraphobic, unable to be touched. The mobile beeped. Automatically, Robin picked it up and looked at it. All right, I believe it's you. Robin could not take in what she was reading and set the mobile down on the sofa without responding. Men looked so tragic when they cried. Matthew's eyes were scarlet. His shoulders heaved. Matt, she said in a low voice over his silent sobs. Matt. She held out her hand. Chapter 38. Dance on Stilts. The sky was marbled pink, but the streets were still heaving with people. A million Londoners and out-of-towners swarmed the pavements, red, white and blue hats, Union Jacks and plastic crowns, beer-swilling buffoons clutching the hands of children with painted faces, all of them bobbing and eddying on a tide of mawkish sentiment. They filled the tube, they packed the streets, and as he forced his way through them, looking for what he needed, he heard more than once the refrain of the national anthem, sung tunelessly by the tipsy, and once with virtuosity by a gaggle of rollicking Welsh women who blocked his way out of the station. He had left it sobbing. The wedding had lifted it temporarily out of its misery, led to cloying affection and self-pitying tears, to plaintive hints about commitment and companionship. He had kept his temper only because his every nerve, every atom of his being focused on what he was going to do tonight. Focused on the release that was coming. He had been patient and loving. But his reward had been it taking the biggest liberty yet, and trying to prevent him leaving. He had already put on the jacket that accommodated his knives, and he had cracked. Although he had not laid a finger on it, he knew how to terrify and intimidate with words alone. With body language, with a sudden revelation of the beast inside. He had slammed his way out of the house, leaving it cowed and appalled behind him. He would have to work hard to make up for that, he reflected, as he pushed his way through a crowd of drinkers on a pavement. A bunch of poxy flowers, some fake regret, some bullshit about being stressed. The thought turned his expression mean. Nobody dared challenge him, not with his size and demeanour, though he knocked into several of them, ploughing his way through them. They were like skittles, fleshy ninepins, and they had about as much life and meaning to him. People had significance in his life only in what they could do for him. That was how the secretary had come to assume such importance. He had never tracked a woman for so long. Yes, the last one had taken a while too, but that had been different. That dumb little bitch had toppled so gleefully into his clutches, you'd have thought getting hacked to pieces was her life's ambition. Which, of course, it had been. The thought of it made him smile. The peach towels and the stink of her blood. He was starting to get the feeling again. That feeling of omnipotence. He was going to get one tonight. He could feel it. Heading for a meeting, shining up my greeting. He was on the lookout for a girl who would become separated from the massing throngs, addled with drink and sentimentality. But they moved in herds through the streets, so he was starting to think he'd be better with a whore after all. Times had changed. It wasn't how it had been in the old days. Hookers didn't need to walk the streets anymore, not with mobile phones and the internet. Buying yourself a woman was as easy as dialing up a takeaway nowadays, but he didn't want to leave a trail online or on some bitch's mobile records. Only the dregs were left on the streets, and he knew all the areas. But it had to be somewhere that he had no association with, somewhere a long way from it. By 10 to midnight he was in Shacklewell, walking the streets with his lower face concealed by the upturned collar of his jacket, his hat low on his forehead, the knives bouncing heavily against his chest as he walked, one a straightforward carving knife, the other a compact machete. Lit windows of curry houses and more pubs, Union Jack bunting everywhere. If it took all night, he would find her. On a dark corner stood three women in tiny skirts, smoking, talking. He passed by on the other side of the street, and one of them called out to him, but he ignored her, passing on into the darkness. Three was too many. Two witnesses left. Hunting was both easier and more difficult on foot. No worries about number plates caught on camera, but the difficulty was where he took her, not to mention the getaway being so much harder. He prowled the streets for another hour until he found himself back on that stretch of road where the three whores had stood. Only two of them now. More manageable. A single witness. His face was almost entirely covered. He hesitated, and as he did so, a car slowed, and the driver had a brief conversation with the girls. One of them got in, and the car drove away. A glorious poison flooded his veins and his brain. It was exactly like the first time he'd killed. Then, too, he had been left with the uglier one, to do with whatever he wanted. No time for hesitation. Either of her mates could come back.
"Back again, babes?"
Her voice was guttural, although she looked young, with red hennaed hair and a shabby bob, piercings in both ears and her nose. Her nostrils were wet and pink, as though she had a cold. Along with her leather jacket and rubber miniskirt, she wore vertiginous heels, on which she seemed to have trouble balancing.
"How much?" he asked,
barely listening to her answer. What mattered was where.
"We can go to my place if you want."
He agreed, but he was tense. It had better be a self-contained room or a bedsit. Nobody on the stairs, no one to hear or see, just some dirty, dark little nook where a body begged to be. If it turned out to be a communal place, some actual brothel, with other girls and a fat old bitch in charge, or worse, a pimp. She wobbled out onto the road before the pedestrian light turned green. He seized her arm and yanked her back as a white van went hurtling past.
"My saviour," she giggled. "Tar babes."
He could tell she was on something. He'd seen plenty like her. Her raw, weeping nose disgusted him. Their reflection in the dark shop windows they passed could have been father and daughter. She was so short and skinny, and he so large, so burly.
"See the wedding?"
she asked.
"What?"
"Royal wedding. She looked lovely."
Even this dirty little whore was wedding crazy. She babbled on about it as they walked, laughing far too often, teetering on her cheap stilettos, while he remained entirely silent.
"Shame his mum never saw him marry, though, innit?" "Here we go," said the girl, pointing to a tenement a block ahead. "That's my gaff."
He could see it in the distance. There were people standing around the lit door, a man sitting on the steps. He stopped dead.
"No."
"Smatter?" "Don't worry about them, babes. They know me," she said earnestly.
"No,"
he said again, his hand tight around her thin arm, suddenly furious. What was she trying to pull? Did she think he was born yesterday?
"Down there,"
he said, pointing to a shadowy space between two buildings.
Babes, there's a bed
down there, he repeated angrily. She blinked at him out of heavily made-up eyes, a little phased, but her thought processes were fogged, the silly bitch, and he convinced her silently by sheer force of personality.
Yeah, all right, babes.
Their footsteps crunched on a surface that seemed to be part gravel. He was afraid there might be security lights or sensors, but a thicker, deeper darkness awaited them 20 yards off the road. His hands were gloved. He handed over the notes. She unzipped his trousers for him. He was still soft. While she was busy on her knees in the darkness, trying to persuade him into tumescence, he was pulling his knives silently from their hiding place inside his jacket. A sliver of nylon lining, one in each hand, his palms sweaty on the plastic handles. He kicked her so hard in the stomach that she flew backwards through the air. A choking, wheezing gasp, then a crunch of gravel told him where she had landed. Lurching forward, his fly still open, his trousers sliding down his hips, he found her by tripping over her and was on her. The carving knife plunged and plunged. He hit bone, probably rib, and stabbed again. A whistle from her lungs and then, shocking him, she screamed. Though he was straddling her, she was fighting, and he could not find her throat to finish her. He gave a mighty left-handed swing with the machete, but incredibly, she still had enough life in her to shriek again. A stream of obscenities poured from his mouth. Stab, stab, and stab again with the carving knife. He punctured her palm as she tried to stop him, and that gave him an idea. Slamming her arm down, kneeling on it, he raised his knife.
You fucking little cocksucking.
Who's down there? Fucking hell and shit. A man's voice, coming out of the dark from the direction of the street, said again, Who's there? He scrambled off her, pulling up his pants and his trousers, backing away as quietly as he could. Two knives in his left hand, and what he thought were two of her fingers in his right, still warm, bony, and bleeding. She was still moaning and whimpering. Then, with a last long wheeze, she fell silent. He hobbled away into the unknown, away from her motionless form, every sense as sharp as a cat's, to the distant approach of a hound.
"Everything all right down there?"
said an echoing male voice. He had reached a solid wall. He felt his way along it until it turned into wire mesh. By the distant light of a street lamp, he saw the outlines of what looked like a ramshackle car repair shop beyond the fence, the hulking forms of vehicles eerie in the gloom. Somewhere in the space he had just left he heard footsteps. The man had come to investigate the screams. He must not panic. He must not run. Noise would be fatal. Slowly he edged along the wire enclosure containing the old cars, towards a patch of darkness that might be either an opening onto an adjoining street or a dead end. He slid the bloody knives back inside his jacket, dropped her fingers into his pocket, and crept along, trying not to breathe. An echoing shout from the alleyway,
"Fucking hell! Andy! Andy!"
He began to run. They would not hear him now, not with their yells echoing off the walls, and as though the universe were once again his friend, it laid soft, grassy ground beneath his feet as he lumbered into the new darkness of the opening. A dead end. A 6-foot wall. He could hear traffic on the other side. Nothing else for it. Panting, scrambling, wishing he were what he had once been, fit and strong and young, he tried to hoist himself up, his feet trying to find some purchase, his muscles screaming in protest. Panic can do wonderful things. He was on top of the wall and down again. He landed heavily, his knees protested, but he staggered, then regained his balance.
Walk on, walk on. Normal, normal, normal.
Cars whooshed past. Surreptitiously, he wiped his bloody hands on his jacket. Distant shouting, too muffled to hear. He needed to get away from here as quickly as possible. He would go to the place that it didn't know about. A bus stop. He jogged a short distance and joined the queue. It didn't matter where he went as long as it took him out of here. His thumb made a bloody mark on the ticket. He pushed it deep into his pocket and made contact with her severed fingers. The bus rumbled away. He took long, slow breaths, trying to calm himself. Somebody upstairs began singing the national anthem again. The bus sped up. His heart jolted. Slowly, his breathing returned to normal. Staring at his own reflection in the filthy window, he rolled her still warm little finger between his own. As panic receded, elation took its place. He grinned at his dark reflection, sharing his triumph with the only one who could understand. Chapter 39. The door opens both ways. Blue Oyster Cult, out of the darkness. "Look at this," said Ellen on Monday morning, standing aghast in front of the television with a bowl of granola in her hands. "Can you believe it?" Strike had just entered the kitchen, freshly washed and dressed, after their usual Sunday night rendezvous. The spotless cream and white space was full of stainless steel surfaces and subdued lighting, like a space-age operating theatre. A plasma TV hung on the wall behind the table. President Obama was on screen, standing at a podium, talking. "They've killed Osama bin Laden," said Ellen.
"Bloody hell," said Strike, stopping dead to read the ticker tape running across the bottom of the screen.
Clean clothes and a shave had made little difference to his hangdog look of exhaustion. The hours he was putting in, trying to catch a glimpse of Lang or Whittaker, were beginning to take their painful toll. His eyes were bloodshot, and his skin was tinged with grey. He crossed to the coffee maker, poured himself a mugful, and gulped it down. He had almost fallen asleep on top of Ellen last night, and counted it among the week's few small achievements that he had finished the job at least. Now he leaned against the steel-topped island, watching the immaculate president, and envying him from his soul. He, at least, had got his man. The known details of bin Laden's death gave Ellen and Strike something to talk about while she was dropping him off at the tube. "I wonder how sure they were it was him," she said, pulling up outside the station, "before they went in." Strike had been wondering that too. Bin Laden had been physically distinctive, of course, well over 6 feet tall, and Strike's thoughts drifted back to Brockbank, Lang, and Whittaker, until Ellen recalled them. "I've got work drinks on Wednesday, if you fancy it." She sounded slightly self-conscious. "Duncan and I have nearly agreed everything. I'm sick of sneaking around."
"Sorry, no can do," he said. "Not with all these surveillance jobs on, I told you."
He had to pretend to her that the pursuit of Brockbank, Lang and Whittaker were paid jobs, because she would never have understood his so far fruitless persistence otherwise. "Okay. Well, I'll wait for you to ring me then," she said. And he caught, but chose to ignore, a cool undertone in her voice.
"Is it worth it?" he asked himself, as he descended into the underground, backpack over his shoulder, with reference not to the men he was pursuing, but to Ellen.
What had begun as an agreeable diversion was starting to assume the status of onerous obligation. The predictability of their rendezvous, same restaurants, same nights, had started to pall. Yet now that she offered to break the pattern, he found himself unenthusiastic. He could think offhand of a dozen things he would rather do with a night off than have drinks with a bunch of Radio 3 presenters. Sleep headed the list. Soon, he could feel it coming, she would want to introduce him to her daughter. In 37 years, Strike had successfully avoided the status of mummy's boyfriend. His memories of the men who had passed through Leda's life, some of them decent, most of them not, the latter trend reaching its apotheosis in Whittaker, had left him with a distaste
that was almost revulsion. He had no desire to see in another child's eyes the fear and mistrust that he had read in his sister Lucy's every time the door opened onto yet another male stranger. What his own expression had been, he had no idea. For as long as he had been able to manage it, he had closed his mind willfully to that part of Leda's life, focusing on her hugs and her laughter, her maternal delight in his achievements. As he climbed out of the tube at Notting Hill Gate on his way to the school, his mobile buzzed. Mad Dad's estranged wife had texted. "Just checking, you know boy's not at school today because of bank holiday. There with grandparents. He won't follow them there." Strike swore under his breath. He had indeed forgotten about the bank holiday. On the plus side, he was now free to return to the office, catch up with some paperwork, then head out to Catford Broadway by daylight for a change. He only wished that the text could have arrived before he made the detour to Notting Hill. 45 minutes later, Strike was tramping up the metal staircase towards his office, and asking himself for the umpteenth time why he had never contacted the landlord about getting the birdcage lift fixed. When he reached the glass door of his office, however, a far more pressing question presented itself. Why were the lights on? Strike pushed open the door so forcefully that Robin, who had heard his laborious approach, nevertheless jumped in her chair. They stared at each other, she defiant, he accusing. "What are you doing here?" "Working," said Robin. "I told you to work from home." "I finished," she said, tapping a sheaf of papers that lay on the desk beside her, covered with handwritten notes and telephone numbers. "Those are all the numbers I could find in Shoreditch." Strike's eyes followed her hand, but what caught his attention was not the small stack of neatly written papers she was showing him, but the sapphire engagement ring. There was a pause. Robin wondered why her heart was pummeling her ribs. How ridiculous to feel defensive. It was up to her whether she married Matthew. Ludicrous even to feel she had to state that to herself. "Back on, is it?" Strike said, turning his back on her as he hung up his jacket and backpack. "Yes," said Robin. There was a short pause. Strike turned back to face her.
"I haven't got enough work for you. We're down to one job. I can cover Mad Dad on my own."
She narrowed her grey-blue eyes. "What about Brockbank and Lang and Whittaker?"
"What about them?"
"Aren't you still trying to find them?"
"Yes, but that's not the... So how are you going to cover four cases?" "They're not cases. No one's paying.
So they're a kind of hobby, are they?" said Robin. "That's why I've been looking for numbers all weekend."
"Look, I want to trace them, yes," said Strike, trying to marshal his arguments through heavy fatigue and other less easily definable emotions. The engagement was back on. He had suspected all along that it might happen. Sending her home, giving her time with Matthew would have helped, of course.
"But I don't..."
"You were happy enough to let me drive you to Barrow," said Robin, who had come prepared for argument. She had known perfectly well he didn't want her back in the office.
"You didn't mind me questioning Holly Brockbank and Lorraine McNaughton, did you? So what's changed?"
"You got sent another fucking body part, that's what's fucking changed, Robin."
He had not intended to shout, but his voice echoed off the filing cabinets. Robin remained impassive. She had seen Strike angry before, heard him swear, seen him punch those very metal drawers. It didn't bother her.
"Yes," she said calmly, "and it shook me up. I think most people would have been shaken up by getting a toe stuck inside a card.
You look pretty sick about it yourself."
"Yeah, which is why..."
"You're trying to cover four cases single-handedly, and you sent me home. I didn't ask for time off." In the euphoric aftermath of replacing her ring, Matthew had actually helped her rehearse her case for returning to work. It had been quite extraordinary, looking back on it, he pretending to be Strike and she putting her arguments, but Matthew had been ready to help her do anything at all, so long as she agreed to marry him on the 2nd of July. "I wanted to get straight back to..."
Just because you wanted to get back to work, said Strike, doesn't mean it was in your best interests to do so.
Oh, I didn't realize you're a qualified occupational therapist, said Robin, delicately sarcastic.
Look, said Strike,
more infuriated by her aloof rationality than he would have been with rage and tears, the sapphire sparkling coolly from her finger again.
I'm your employer, and it's down to me if...
I thought I was supposed to be your partner, said Robin.
Makes no difference, said Strike. Partner or not, I've still got a responsibility, so you'd rather see this business fail than let me work, said Robin,
an angry flush rising in her pale face.
And while Strike felt he was losing on points, he took an obscure pleasure in the fact that she was losing her cool.
I helped you build it up. You're playing right into his hands, whoever he is, sidelining me, neglecting paying cases, and working yourself into the...
How do you know I've...
Because you look like shit, said Robin baldly.
And Strike, caught off guard, almost laughed for the first time in days.
Either, she resumed, I'm your partner or I'm not. If you're going to treat me like some piece of special occasion china that gets taken out when you don't think I'll get hurt, we're doomed. The business is doomed.
I'd do better to take Wardle up on
what? Said Strike sharply.
On his suggestion that I apply to the police, said Robin,
looking Strike squarely in the face.
This isn't a game to me, you know. I'm not a little girl. I've survived far worse than being sent a tow. So,
she screwed up her courage. She had hoped it would not come to an ultimatum.
Decide. Decide whether I'm your partner or a liability. If you can't rely on me, if you can't let me run the same risks you do, then I'd rather...
Her voice nearly broke, but she forced herself onwards.
Rather get out, she finished.
In her emotion, she swung her chair round to face her computer a little too forcefully, and found herself facing the wall. Mustering what dignity she felt she had left, she adjusted her seat to face the monitor and continued opening emails, waiting for his answer. She had not told him about her lead. She needed to know whether she was reinstated as his partner before she either shared her spoils or gave it to him as a farewell gift.
Whoever he is, he butchers women for pleasure, said Strike quietly. And he's made it clear he'd like to do the same to you.
I've grasped that, said Robin in a tight voice, her eyes on the screen. But have you grasped the fact that if he knows where I work, he probably also knows where I live? And if he's that determined, he'll follow me anywhere I go. Can't you understand that I'd much rather help catch him than sit around waiting for him to pounce? She was not going to beg. She had emptied the inbox of 12 spam emails before he spoke again, his voice heavy.
All right.
All right what? She asked, looking around cautiously.
All right, you're back at work.
She beamed. He did not return the smile.
Oh, cheer up, she said, getting to her feet and moving around the desk.
For one crazy moment, Strike thought she might be about to hug him. She looked so happy, and with the protective ring back on her finger, perhaps he had become a safely huggable figure, a de-sexed non-competitor. But she was merely heading for the kettle. I've got a lead, she told him.
Yeah, he said,
still struggling to make sense of the new situation. What was he going to ask her to do that wasn't too dangerous? Where could he send her?
Yes, she said. I've made contact with one of the people on the BIID forum who was talking to Kelsey. Yawning widely, Strike dropped down into the fake leather sofa, which made its usual flatulent noises under his weight, and tried to remember whom she was talking about. He was so sleep-deprived that his usually capacious and accurate memory was becoming unreliable.
"The bloke or the woman?" he asked,
with a vague remembrance of the photographs Wardle had shown them.
"The man," said Robin, pouring boiling water onto tea bags.
For the first time in their relationship, Strike found himself relishing an opportunity to undermine her.
So you've been going onto websites without telling me? Playing games with a bunch of anonymous punters without knowing who you're messing with?
I told you I'd been on there, said Robin indignantly. I saw Kelsey asking questions about you on a message board, remember? She was calling herself Nowhere to Turn. I told you all this when Wardle was here. He was impressed, she added.
He's also way ahead of you, said Strike. He's questioned both of those people she was talking to online. It's a dead end. They never met her. He's working on a guy called Devotee now, who was trying to meet women off the site.
I already know about Devotee.
How?
He asked to see my picture, and when I didn't send it, he went quiet.
So, you've been flirting with these nutters, have you?
Oh, for God's sake, said Robin impatiently. I've been pretending I've got the same disorder they have. It's hardly flirting. And I don't think Devotee's anything to worry about. She passed Stryker a mug of tea, which was precisely his preferred shade of creosote. Perversely, this aggravated rather than soothed him.
So you don't think Devotee's anything to worry about? What are you basing that on?
I've been doing some research into acrotomophiliacs ever since that letter came in addressed to you. The man who was fixated on your leg, remember? As paraphilias go, it's hardly ever associated with violence. I think Devotee's much more likely to be masturbating over his keyboard at the idea of all the wannabes.
Unable to think of any response to this, Strike drank some tea.
Anyway, said Robin. His lack of thanks for his tea had rankled. The guy Kelsey was talking to online, he wants to be an amputee too, lied to Wardle.
What do you mean he lied?
He did meet Kelsey in real life.
Yeah? Said Strike,
determinedly casual.
How do you know that?
He's told me all about it. He was terrified when the Met contacted him. None of his family or his friends knows about his obsession with getting rid of his leg. So he panicked and said he'd never met Kelsey. He was afraid that if he admitted he had, there would be publicity and he'd have to give evidence in court. Anyway, once I'd convinced him that I am who I am, that I'm not a journalist or a policewoman.
You told him the truth?
Yes, which was the best thing I could have done. Because once he was convinced I was really me, he agreed to meet.
And what makes you think he's genuinely going to meet you? Asked Strike.
Because we've got leverage with him that the police haven't.
Like what?
Like, she said coldly, wishing that she could have returned a different answer. You. Jason's absolutely desperate to meet you.
Me? Said Strike, completely thrown. Why?
Because he believes you cut your leg off yourself.
What?
Kelsey convinced him that you did it yourself. He wants to know how.
Jesus fucking Christ, said Strike. Is he mentally ill? Of course he is, he answered himself immediately. Of course he's mentally ill. He wants to cut his fucking leg off. Jesus fucking Christ.
Well, you know, there's a debate about whether BIID is a mental illness or some kind of brain abnormality, said Robin. When you scan the brain of someone suffering
whatever, said Strike, waving the topic away. What makes you think this nutter's got anything useful?
He met Kelsey, said Robin impatiently, who must have told him why she was so convinced you were one of them. He's 19 years old. He works in an Asda in Leeds. He's got an aunt in London, and he's going to come down, stay with her and meet me. We're trying to find a date. He needs to find out when he can get the time off. Look, he's two removes from the person who convinced Kelsey you were a voluntary amputee, she went on, both disappointed and annoyed by Strike's lack of enthusiasm for the results of her solo work, but still holding out a faint hope that he would stop being so tetchy and critical. And that person is almost certainly the killer. Strike drank more tea, allowing what she had told him to percolate slowly through his exhausted brain. Her reasoning was sound. Persuading Jason to meet her was a significant achievement. He ought to offer praise. Instead, he sat in silence, drinking his tea. If you think I should call Wardle and pass this over to him, said Robin, her resentment palpable.
No, said Strike, and the haste with which he answered gave Robin some small satisfaction. Until we've heard what is... We won't waste Wardle's time. We'll let him know once we've heard what this Jason's got. When did you say he's coming to London?
He's trying to get time off. I don't know yet.
One of us could go up to Leeds and meet him.
He wants to come down. He's trying to keep all this away from anyone who knows him.
Okay, said Strike, gruffly, rubbing his bloodshot eyes and trying to formulate a plan that would keep Robin simultaneously busy and out of harm's way. You keep the pressure on him, then, and start ringing round those numbers. See whether you can get a lead on Brockbank.
I've already started doing that, she said, and he heard the latent rebelliousness, the imminent insistence that she wanted to be back on the street.
And, said Strike, thinking fast, I want you to stake out Wollaston Close.
Looking for Lang?
Exactly. Keep a low profile, don't stay there after dark, and if you see the beanie bloke, you get out of there or set off your bloody rape alarm, preferably both.
Even Strike's surliness could not douse Robin's delight that she was back on board, a fully equal partner in the business. She could not know that Strike believed and hoped that he was sending her up a dead end. By day and by night, he had watched the entrances to the small block of flats, shifting position regularly, using night vision goggles to scan the balconies and windows. Nothing he had seen indicated that Lang was lurking within. No broad shadow moving behind a curtain, no hint of a low-growing hairline or dark ferret-like eyes. No massive figure swaying along on crutches, or, because Strike took nothing for granted when it came to Donald Lang, swaggering along like the ex-boxer he was. Every man who had passed in and out of the building had been scrutinized by Strike for a hint of resemblance to Lang's just-giving photograph, or to the faceless figure in the beanie hat, and none of them had come close to a match.
Yeah, he said. You get on to Lang and... Give me half those Brockbank numbers. We'll divide them up. I'll stick with Whittaker. Make sure you check in regularly, okay?
He heaved himself out of the sofa. Of course, said Robin, elated. Oh, and Cormoran? He was already on the way to the inner office, but turned. What are these? She was holding up the Accutane pills that he had found in Kelsey's drawer and which he had left in Robin's inn tray after looking them up online.
Oh, them, he said. They're nothing.
Some of her cheeriness seemed to evaporate. A faint guilt stirred. He knew he was being a grumpy bastard. She didn't deserve it. He tried to pull himself together.
Acne medication, he said. They were Kelsey's.
Of course. You went to the house. You saw her sister. What happened? What did she say? Strike did not feel equal to telling her all about Hazel Furley now. The interview felt a long time ago. He was exhausted and still felt unreasonably antagonistic.
Nothing new, he said. Nothing important.
So why did you take these pills?
I thought they might be birth control. Maybe she was up to something her sister didn't know about.
Oh, said Robin. So they really are nothing. She tossed them into the bin. Ego made Strike go on. Ego, pure and simple. She had found a good lead, and he had nothing except a vague idea about the Accutane.
And I found a ticket, he said.
A what?
Like a coat check ticket.
Robin waited expectantly.
Number 18, said Strike.
Robin waited for a further explanation, but none came. Strike yawned and conceded defeat.
I'll see you later. Keep me posted on what you're up to and where you are.
He let himself into his office, closed the door, sat down at his desk, and slumped backwards in his chair. He had done all he could to stop her getting back on the street. Now, he wanted nothing more than to hear her leave. Chapter 40. Love is like a gun, and in the hands of someone like you, I think it'd kill. Blue Oyster Cult, searching for Celine. Robin was a decade younger than Strike. She had arrived in his office as a temporary secretary, unsought and unwelcome, at the lowest point of his professional life. He had only meant to keep her on for a week, and that because he had almost knocked her to her death down the metal stairs when she arrived, and he felt he owed her. Somehow, she had persuaded him to let her stay, firstly for an extra week, then for a month, and finally, forever. She had helped him claw his way out of near insolvency, worked to make his business successful, learned on the job, and now asked nothing more than to be allowed to stand beside him while that business crumbled again, and to fight for its survival. Everyone liked Robin. He liked Robin. How could he fail to like her after everything they had been through together? However, from the very first, he told himself, this far and no further. A distance must be maintained. Barriers must remain in place. She had entered his life on the very day that he had split from Charlotte for good, after 16 years of an on-off relationship that he still could not say had been more pleasurable than painful. Robin's helpfulness, her solicitousness, her fascination with what he did, her admiration for him personally, if he was going to be honest with himself, he should do it thoroughly, had been balm to those wounds that Charlotte had inflicted, those internal injuries that had long outlasted her parting gifts of a black eye and lacerations. The sapphire on Robin's third finger had been a bonus then, a safeguard and a full stop. In preventing the possibility of anything more, it set him free to, what? Rely on her? Befriend her? Allow barriers to become imperceptibly eroded, so that as he looked back, it occurred to him that they had each shared personal information that hardly anybody else knew. Robin was one of only 3 people, he suspected, who knew about that putative baby that Charlotte claimed to have lost, but which might never have existed, or was aborted. He was one of a mere handful who knew that Matthew had been unfaithful. For all his determination to keep her at arm's length, they had literally leaned on each other. He could remember exactly what it felt like to have his arm around her waist as they had meandered towards Hazlitt's hotel. She was tall enough to hold easily. He did not like having to stoop. He had never fancied very small women. Matthew would not like this, she had said. He would have liked it even less had he known how much Strike had liked it. She was nowhere near as beautiful as Charlotte. Charlotte had had the kind of beauty that made men forget themselves mid-sentence, that stunned them into silence. Robin, as he could hardly fail to notice when she bent over to turn off her PC at the wall, was a very sexy girl. But men were not struck dumb in her presence. Indeed, remembering Wardle, she seemed to make them more loquacious. Yet he liked her face, he liked her voice, he liked being around her. It wasn't that he wanted to be with her. That would be insanity. They could not run the business together and have an affair. In any case, she wasn't the kind of girl you had an affair with. He had only ever known her engaged, or else bereft at the demise of her engagement, and therefore saw her as the kind of woman who was destined for marriage. Almost angrily, he added together those things he knew and had observed that marked her as profoundly different from him, as embodying a safer, more cloistered, more conventional world. She had had the same pompous boyfriend since sixth form, although he understood that a little better now, a nice middle-class family back in Yorkshire, parents married for decades and apparently happy, a Labrador and a Land Rover, and a pony, Strike reminded himself. A bloody pony. Then other memories intruded, and a different Robin peeled away from this picture of a safe and ordered past. And there in front of him stood a woman who would not have been out of place in the SIB. This was the Robin who had taken advanced driving courses,
who had concussed herself in the pursuit of a killer, who had calmly wrapped her coat like a tourniquet around his bleeding arm after he was stabbed and taken him to hospital. The Robin who had improvised so successfully in interrogating suspects that she had winkled out information that the police had not managed to get. Who had invented and successfully embodied Venetia Hall. Who had persuaded a terrified young man who wanted his leg amputated to confide in her. Who had given Strike 100 other examples of initiative, resourcefulness and courage that might have turned her into a plainclothes police officer by now, had she not once walked into a dark stairwell where a bastard in a mask stood waiting. And that woman was going to marry Matthew. Matthew, who had been banking on her working in human resources with a nice salary to complement his own, who sulked and bitched about her long, unpredictable hours and her lousy paycheck. Couldn't she see what a stupid bloody thing she was doing? Why the fuck had she put that ring back on? Hadn't she tasted freedom on that drive up to Barrow, which Strike looked back on with a fondness that discomposed him? She's making a fucking huge mistake, that's all. That was all. It wasn't personal. Whether she was engaged, married, or single, nothing could or ever would come of the weakness he was forced to acknowledge that he had developed. He would re-establish the professional distance that had somehow ebbed away with her drunken confessions and the camaraderie of their trip up north, and temporarily shelve his half-acknowledged plan to end the relationship with Ellen. It felt safer just now to have another woman within reach, and a beautiful one at that, whose enthusiasm and expertise in bed ought surely to compensate for an undeniable incompatibility outside it. He fell to wondering how long Robin would continue working for him after she became Mrs. Cunliffe. Matthew would surely use every ounce of his husbandly influence to prise her away from a profession as dangerous as it was poorly paid. Well, that was her lookout. Her bed, and she could lie in it. Except that once you had broken up, it was much easier to do so again. He ought to know. How many times had he and Charlotte split? How many times had their relationship fallen to pieces, and how many times had they tried to reassemble the wreckage? There had been more cracks than substance by the end. They had lived in a spider's web of fault lines, held together by hope, pain, and delusion. Robin and Matthew had just 2 months to go before the wedding. There was still time. Chapter 41. See there a scarecrow who waves through the mist. Blue Oyster Cult, out of the darkness. It happened quite naturally that Strike saw Robin very little over the following week. They were staking out different locations and exchanged information almost exclusively over their mobiles. As Strike had expected, neither Wollaston Close nor its environs had revealed any trace of the ex-King's Own Royal Borderer. But he had been no more successful in spotting his man in Catford. The emaciated Stephanie entered and left the flat over the chip shop a few more times. Although he could not be there around the clock, Strike was soon pretty sure that he had seen her entire wardrobe, a few pieces of dirty jersey and one tatty hoodie. If, as Shanker had confidently asserted, she was a prostitute, she was working infrequently. While he took care never to let her see him, Strike doubted that her hollow eyes would retain much of an impression even if he had moved into plain view. They had become shuttered, full of inner darkness, no longer taking in the outside world. Strike had tried to ascertain whether Whittaker was almost permanently inside or almost constantly absent from the flat in Catford Broadway. But there was no landline registered for the address, and the property was listed online as owned by a Mr. Dershack, who was either renting it or unable to get rid of his squatters. The detective was standing smoking beside the stage door one evening, watching the lit windows and wondering whether he was imagining movement behind them, when his mobile buzzed and he saw Wardle's name.
"Strike here, what's up?"
"Bit of a development, I think," said the policeman.
Looks like our friend struck again. Strike moved the mobile to his other ear, away